Leaders Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Diane Wald. And Diane is a poet and novelist who has lived most of her life in Massachusetts. She has an MFA from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. She's worked as a library assistant, an English professor, an in-house writer for National Animal Welfare Organization, and other things. Her novella, Gillyflower, was published in 2019 and won first place awards from the Next Generation Indie Book Awards and the American Book Fest, among others. And then she's written other novels and published more than 250 poems in literary magazines. She's the recipient of a two-year fellowship in poetry from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown and has been awarded many, many prizes. So her latest work we're talking about today is The Bay Rose Files, winner of the Novella Award from the Next Generation Indie Book Awards. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Diane.
Thank you so much.
So The Bay Rose Files is a novella. Not a lot of novellas get published, it seems. Yeah. So tell us what makes something a novella and why you seem to gravitate to that form.
Well, a novella is simply a compact novel. And I didn't gravitate towards it with Gillyflower. It just kind of happened to me because that was the first longish piece of prose that I'd written. I was always writing poetry before that. And I decided I would just write it until the story was over and not worry about padding it or bringing in characters who didn't advance the theme. And so that went pretty well, and it was a lot of fun to write it. The next book was very long. You know, it was almost 400 pages, I think.
And, oh, wow.
But that was a longer story. So I guess I just feel like you just have to let the story breathe in whatever space it needs and not try to manage it too much.
So What is the cutoff length for a novella?
I think usually they say 40,000 words,
okay.
Maybe 50,000.
And your typical novel is...
More than
300,000 words. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know about words.
Oh, words. Okay.
Pages and figures.
Oh, you're thinking pages. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think of a hefty novel as 300 to 400 pages.
Right, right. And what did you say for novella?
Novella, well, this one, I think Gillyflower was 125 pages. This one's only 116.
Okay. And where's the cutoff on the other end between a short story and a novella?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question because a lot of times if you're looking online for places to submit your work, it'll say long short story or short novella. So somewhere in there, there's a cutoff. I don't know exactly what it is. Again, I think, you know, a short story maybe has fewer characters and sooner than a novella. A novella gives you a little more room to develop them.
Right, right.
But I couldn't give you a number of words for a short story. Some of them are, you know, now everybody's into flash fiction, which is over in a minute. And then there are really long short stories that go for 20, 30 pages.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So in the Bay Rose Files, which is set in Provincetown, right? At a writing center, a writing retreat.
It's an artist writer's colony.
Okay. And is that similar to the where you had your fellowship in Provincetown?
Yes. Let me tell you how this all came about. So, when I was at the Fine Arts Work Center, that was 1973. I'm very, very old. So I was in my 20s then. And I felt so lucky. And I got the fellowship, a two-year fellowship in poetry. So I was there in the 70s as a poet. And the character in The Bay Rose Files is there as a fiction writer in the 1980s. I was dying to write a book about my experiences in Provincetown. First of all, because I've always loved the place. I mean, my my parents took us there once a year, probably for a day while we were doing other things on Cape Cod. And I just, I don't know what, it's a magical place. Have you been there?
No, I haven't.
You gotta go. It's really, really different.
What makes really it special? Different. What makes it
special? It's special. Well, it's known as a haven for gay people, but that's not all it is. What it really started out as is an incredibly colorful fishing village and a place where artists and writers from long, long ago have always gone because it's so isolated and it's so quirky and interesting. Some of the houses in Provincetown were actually floated across the bay because in those days it was too expensive to buy timber to build houses. So you just jacked up your house, put it on a barge and took it over to Provincetown. So, I mean, it has amazing, really interesting history to it. So then it became, you know, the artists and the writers, and then it became a place where gay people could go, or any people could go and be accepted. That's what I loved about it. It seemed, there's a thing, a place in the book where I talk about how it's a place where anybody can go and just feel accepted for who they are. They don't have to put on airs or try to be something they're not. And it's very, very accepting, I found. When I lived there for 2 years on a fellowship and then a third year on my own. And I just found it to be a very compassionate place to live.
Oh, so
not to mention beautiful.
Is it on an island?
No, it's on the very, very tip of the peninsula. If you picture Massachusetts in your mind and it has that long arm sticking out from it, Provincetown is at the very, very tip.
Okay. So why'd you leave?
Oh, well, it's one thing I would say about it is it's isolated in a way. So, you know, there aren't any universities there or any city life or anything. So if you're young, I was very young then, and I wanted to go to grad school, and I wanted to maybe become a teacher and all that kind of thing. And you couldn't do that from there. It's hard to make a living unless you're a famous artist or a famous writer or a Fisher person. So that's why I left. But I never really left in my heart.
And do you go back? Do you visit?
Yeah. My husband and I have been going back once a year. We go in October when it's not so crowded and not so expensive. You know, now it's kind of a very expensive place to go and live. It's also so gorgeous in the fall because the beaches are clear and the sky is full of interesting maritime clouds, you know, and there's a lot going on. So it's really, really nice.
So in the Bayrose Files, you have a young woman, Violet Maris, who goes to this writer's colony. How much is she you?
Not very much, thank goodness. I don't think so. Although I like Violet very much, but she didn't really know what she was doing until the end of the book. She had to get slapped around by fate a bit before she kind of came to her senses, because I think she went into her, you know, the beginning of the book, she starts out by saying, "My name is Violet Maris and I've done a terrible thing." Well, she didn't really realize how terrible the thing was when she was doing it. And she should have at that age, you know. Mm. So I think a lot of people have called it a coming of age story, which I guess it kind of is. I always think of coming of age stories as being for much younger people, but maybe she was a late bloomer. It took her a while to figure things out. She had to be kind of shocked into realizing what she had done and how it was affecting people.
Well, I mean, I don't think it was so terrible it should ruin the rest of her life.
Well, you're very kind. It's a pretty terrible deception. I mean, if you're an artist or a writer and somebody pulls off a fake like that, well, she was taking a fellowship space that some real artist could have used.
Right.
She was taking money from a nonprofit, you know, she was deceiving everybody, including herself, pretty much.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give away too many spoilers here, but it's at least she wasn't deceiving the true artist. You know, the person whose things she was faking, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he's really important. He's very important.
He's very important. And to me, that makes it not all that bad.
That's good to hear. Yeah. I mean, I don't think she certainly was not a mean person. She let her childish ambition and run away with her at the beginning without, she had blinders on. She didn't really, you know, look at what else was going to happen.
Yeah. So she went in there thinking she was going to do some big expose, right?
Right.
But why? What was it about that she thought that there would be, what was it she wanted to expose?
I think she thought there would be like a lot of craziness, you know, maybe a lot of people having a lot of strange sexual encounters, or people, you know, drinking a lot or taking drugs. Or I think she thought, because the place was so new at the time and nobody knew anything about it, and it was way out there on the tip of Cape Cod, I think she thought there must be something that they're not telling us, and I'm going to get in there and find it. And she also realized that nobody else had done anything. Nobody had written much about it yet. She thought maybe this could be her big break.
So have there been journalists who have written about other, like, famous writers' colonies, or, you know, is that a thing?
Yeah. I think so. Well, I mean, I can't think of one off the top of my head. I do know, you know, a few people who were in the fellowship program when I was, and after that, have written things about their experiences there. They weren't totally fictional. Most of theirs had either composite characters, you know, like, I knew these three women and I combined them all into one person. This isn't like that. This is completely fictional, except for the setting and, you know, the plot. And I know the plot is fictional, but
right.
The characters are not composite, and it's not a true story, and it's not really about me.
So, but do people sometimes think it might be? Do you get that sometimes?
Nice. No, that's a risk you take. Yeah.
So, when you decided you wanted to write about this writer's colony, how did the story come to you? It's like, did you know from the beginning kind of what the plot was going to be, or did that sort of come as you, or did you start with this with Violet and just, you know, how did you start?
This is unlike any other book I've done. It happened during the pandemic when I, like everybody I knew, was going crazy being at home all the time. And in the summer, I guess it was, so that started in 2020, more or less. I think that summer I was out on the porch of my house, just reading and thinking and mulling over everything, and, you know, being addicted to the news like everybody else. And I suddenly got this idea, the first lines in my head, my name is Violet Maris and I've done a terrible thing. And I thought, who is that? And what terrible thing could she possibly have done? And then I realized that was the key to writing this book about Provincetown that I'd always wanted to write. Like, now I had my crazy character and I knew she'd done something really bad. So I just started thinking about what would have been, when I was living there, what would have been the worst thing? What would have been terrible besides, you know, I didn't want to write about murder or robbery or anything. What would be so terrible? And I think it was deception and secrecy and all of these things. I mean, the epigraph on the book is from the most mysterious writer of all, Leonard Cohen, And he says, don't call yourself a secret unless you want to keep it. So she had a lot of secrets. She thought she was going to discover a lot of secrets about other people, but that kind of didn't happen. But, you know, it enabled me to create other characters who were going to help work out the plot. I knew what she did. Once I knew what she did, I knew what would happen to her. It was filling in the middle that was interesting.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Now, you said you didn't base the other characters on real people there, but did you maybe base them on any of them on real people you've met in other circumstances?
Oh, only in a vague sort of way. I mean, I've been lucky. I've known a lot of writers and artists, and not only from experiences at Provincetown and school, but for 6 or 7 years, I was dean of faculty at an art school. So I met all these, not only the kids who were aspiring artists, and pretty crazy. That was in the early 90s. The teachers there, some of whom were just amazing artists. But they were all offbeat characters, you know? So I might have pulled a little from things like that.
Right, right. Now, how does your poetry, you know, your work in poetry, influence your prose writing?
I think it really does. You know, imagery is maybe the most important thing to do when I'm writing poetry. So it's combining imagery with emotion. And so I try to do that in the fiction. And it's also a case of going from the word to the paragraph to the sentence to the story, you know, starting with small things and getting larger. I think that's how it does. And I'd look, once I've written a long piece of prose, I'd go back over it so many times, making sure that I can make the sentences as good as they can be. I don't want them to just be, you know, Jane walked down the street and went into a store. And they have to sound good to me. So that's from poetry too, I think.
So you pay attention to every word and every sentence.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, of course, there have to be a lot of plain Jane sentences in the book that size, but there are a lot of them that I worked on quite a bit to make them sound good and make them present the images that I wanted people to see.
Now, when I talk to poets, I often ask like how they know when a poem is done, when it's finished. And of course, for some people, it's like, well, it's never really finished. But in this, how do you, as when you're writing poetry, how do you decide when a poem is finished?
I think I might be one of those people. You know, when it's over, it's over. Unless, I mean, there's certain kinds of poetry where you're trying to make a point. Like if it's a short poem and you want to make a point, then you know when you've made it and you should stop writing. But there are other kinds that are more ephemeral, and those are harder to know when they stop. That is true.
Yeah, because and again, like when you're getting a sentence and you want it to sound good, but maybe it sounds good, but could it sound better? And
Yeah, right.
Do you ever find yourself sort of in an endless loop with trying to make it just a little bit better?
With this book?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Because not only do I do that myself, but once you get something published, I mean, Regal House is a great publishing company, and they put you through, they force you through so many loops to get your book out. You know, you're proofreading it, and then you're proofreading it again, and then somebody else reads it, and then they copy edit it, and then you keep looking at it and looking at it, and that happens. Like, you remember you'd be reading along and say, oh, well, my favorite sentence is coming, but I don't like it anymore. I'm gonna change it a little bit. But that's very interesting to me, I think, you know.
And at some point, you just have to put the pen down.
Yeah, yeah. of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the great thing about the Bayrose Files, or as a novella, is that it's a quick read. You know, you can pick it up and read it in an afternoon, really.
Yeah.
But I will say, when I reached the end, I thought, you know, you could have gone on with the story. You could have gone on with Violet.
Yeah.
Why did you choose not to?
That's a question everybody wants to know. And that happened a little bit with my other novella too, but more so with this one, because, well, you know, I think I did give a lot of clues to what happened to Violet and Jean. And I didn't want it to end with the answer. You know, I wanted people to think back over the book. And like, for one thing, I'll say this now because it relates to the piece that I'm going to read. There's a chapter at the very beginning of the book. Violet has an interesting attribute or talent, or I don't know what you'd call it, but she's able to pick up objects, and by the temperature of the object, she gets a feeling that something's going to happen to her. Now, somebody, after I wrote the book, somebody said to me, oh, that's called a thermopath, a word I had never heard before. And I had a hard time looking it up, but it seems that that's true, and that there are actually people who can get a certain kind of heat vibration from objects.
Okay, so when you wrote this, you didn't know that that was a real thing.
No, I didn't know it was a thing. It hadn't happened to me. Well, you know, I pick up hot things and they're hot, and cold things are cold. It never happened to me. I thought I was making it up. But anyway, she, at the beginning of the story and the piece that I'm going to read, Jean slips his business card under her scarf and on the bar. And when she pulls it out, she says it's warm. So there are hints, like, so the thermopath thing gave me a way to clue people in into the little Easter eggs, like they talk about in movies, you know.
Right, right.
Give you a little hint to what's going to happen with this person, or this character is going to be more important than this other person, or Violet's going to put her foot in it pretty soon because she just picked up something that was very hot.
So it's interesting that, you know, this is sort of a supernatural quality or something, except it didn't really feel like that as I was reading. It just seemed very real.
That's good.
Yeah, and not too woo-woo, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's not too spooky. And she doesn't even, it really doesn't even bother her so much. She notices it.
Mm-hmm.
But like most things with Violet, she doesn't put it together for a long time.
Now, are there any other kind of metaphysical or supernatural aspects in the book?
No.
Nope. Okay. So it's interesting that is kind of a main quality for her. It's and her obtuseness.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah. So why don't you read that section for us?
Okay. Great. This is about the fifth chapter in the book, and this comes after she has told everyone that she's interested in Provincetown, and she wants to just go there by herself and mess around and see if she can talk to people. This is before she puts together her terrible plot to fake the stories. So she's just there talking to people. It's called Star of the Sea. "Your name really Violet Maris?" the man said, with a screwed-up expression on his face that would have been appropriate to asking if my name were really Florence Nightingale. I sipped my bourbon. "Yes," I said. "You're aware, of course, of the meaning of your last name." I looked down the bar at him. There were two unmistakable Provincetown locals separating us. One of them had asked me my name, and this character had intercepted the answer. He appeared to be about 40 and was a tad portly, but in that comfortable way some men have that doesn't bother me. He wore prescription-looking sunglasses, a red baseball cap, a dazzlingly white t-shirt, and khaki Bermudas. The shirt was a dead giveaway that he was married. Left to their own devices, men never bleach anything. I had to admit he was attractive, with nice features, the kind of guy you could fancy yourself cuddling up to and watching television with. This guy would talk about art and literature all the time. Even though he looked like a hockey fan, you could just tell. He was smart, but he probably had some sort of mother fixation or something that could never be addressed. All of this passed through my mind in a matter of seconds. I should have been an FBI profiler, I guess. He got up and moved to a stool on the other side of me so we weren't separated by the other customers. "Yeah," I said, "I am aware." He ignored that. "Maris, of Latin origin, meaning of the sea, as in Stella Maris or Star of the Sea, an epithet for the Virgin Mary. Third declension, neuter genitive, indicating possession." "Yeah, as I indicated, I'm aware." "Figures that you would be, of course. From now on, if and when I run into you, I will greet you with Ave Stella Maris, or Hail, Star of the Sea. What a great name to bring to Provincetown." He sighed, clearly pleased with himself. "Thanks," I said. "Cool." I couldn't tell if this was going anywhere. "So will I be seeing much of you around here?" he asked. "I'm not sure," I said. "I'm doing some research." "Oh, boy. Is that a problem?" "No, no," he said, pulling at the brim of his cap. "No problem at all. What are you researching?" "I decided to go for broke." "Well," I said, "are you familiar with The Home?" He stood up and stretched. He smiled at me. It was a really nice smile, white teeth on a tanned face. "I am," he said. "And I'm on the board there." "Wow," I said, "great to meet you. And you are Eugene Pelletier." "Gene." He pronounced it Pelletier. "Don't worry, it's French for fur trader, but that's not me at all." "Okay, then." I looked him over a second time. I just wasn't getting a recognizable vibe. Didn't know if I wanted to trust him. "So how long have you been on the board?" "Right from the beginning." "That is to say, not long. Were you ever a fellow there?" He ordered another Jim Beam and one for me. "I was sort of both for a while," he said. "It was all very informal. Now we have committees and everything. What's your interest in The Home? And by the way, is this on the record?" "No," I said. "Sorry, I should have explained. I've just started thinking about writing an article on The Home, freelance. Decided I should come out here and see what people really thought about it. Plus, I love the town. Do you think there's any possibility I could interview some staff, or better yet, some of the fellows?" Gene Pelletier slowly pulled at his cap again, downed what was left of his bourbon, and stood up next to me. "Miss Maris," he said, "I doubt if any of them would want to participate in anything like that. It's kind of a private space for us, you know. Everybody's there to work on their art. Very nice meeting you." And he was gone. No noise, no drama, just gone as if he had never been there. The tattooed guy next to me laughed and said, "Sorry, honey, old Eugene's a little touchy sometimes." When I got up to leave, I discovered that Gene had slipped his business card under a scarf I'd left folded up on the bar. "Eugene Pelletier," it said in a sort of old Englishy font. "Town meeting member, real estate sales, man about Provincetown." And there was a phone number. I slipped it into my pocket. It was the temperature of a drinkable cup of tea. I stayed in town 3 days. I was able to find 4 people who lived at The Home and 1 who worked here, but every one of them was as close-mouthed as Gene Pelletier. I didn't call him then, but I thought I might someday. The whole scenario was frustrating, but it also fueled my desire to find out more. I had to go back to province to Boston, but I intended to come up with some kind of scheme. I was going to penetrate the sacred wall surrounding the home. I was sure of it.
And that was Diane Wald reading from the Bay Rose Files. And so it begins. So when you wrote this book and your other novels, do you write sequentially in the order that it ends up being published?
Yes and no. I think in the large sense I do, but in the smaller sense I move things around, smaller details, and that causes a lot of proofreading problems because you have to be so careful that, you know, someone doesn't take their shoes off in one chapter and then take them off again 5 minutes later. So it's like just this sort of a juggling act with the smaller details.
Right, right. Are you a pantser or a plotter? Are you familiar with those terms? So it's like most writers, they either plot along and like pay attention as they go, or they're writing by the seat of the pants and they write really fast and then they go back.
Oh, seat of the pants.
Yeah.
I'm a seat of the pantser then. Yes, definitely. Because I don't like to stop once I get going. And I don't, I know a couple of novelists who have storyboards and outlines and all that. I don't have that. I can't do that. I'm very messy. I take a lot of messy notes that I go back to every now and then, but no.
Do you do any character sketches or, you know, keep notes about characters at all?
Yeah, I keep notes about the characters. Mostly, again, because I don't want to make mistakes saying one thing about them in one place and something that contradicts that somewhere else. So I try to keep referring to the characters. But some of them you have more trouble with than others, you know. I didn't have any trouble like that with Violet, but I did with Gene because he came into the story like he was just plopped into the story all of a sudden, and you know, you wanted the readers to know a lot about him, but not all at once. So I had to string it out.
Right, right. So do you write an entire first draft and then go back and start reworking?
No. I would say I do 3 or 4 chapters maybe and then go back over those.
Okay.
And then go on.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then once you get to the end, do you start over with reworking at that point?
Yeah.
With the editing?
Start over, yeah. Start over, and start over.
So how many drafts would you say that you typically do?
I don't know. It's hard to tell with this book because my previous two fiction, works of fiction, had started like a million years ago, when I was only writing poetry and I was terrified of fiction. So I would write these things and put them in a box under my desk. And then I pulled them out, you know, 6 or 7 years ago and started reworking them. So they don't really count, though. They're like antiques that were rediscovered. But this one, it was interesting to rework it maybe before I submitted it to publishers, maybe 5 or 6 renditions, I'm guessing, but
okay.
Around that.
Okay. And now you've also published some poetry chapbooks, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in those, I'm always curious how a poet decides what poems to put into each collection.
It's horrible. It's so horrifying. It's so hard. I mean, there's really, I don't have a big theme for this. Nobody does really. There are some people who will say, you know, write a book about a certain place or a certain person. I've seen that done. That would be such a joy because you would already have a structure for it. But putting together a poetry book, especially the longer ones, is very daunting because you don't know if what you think follows this poem is what other people will feel follows that poem, or if it even matters, because most people don't pick up a book of poetry and read it straight through.
Right, right.
I think they put it down, they come back later, they might flip through it a little, see a title they like, read that one. It's very, very hard. I mean, what I'm doing now is putting together a manuscript of collected and uncollected poems from my first four books, and then adding new things. That's a lot easier because those first four books, they're already set. And so I can pick poems from them, put them in their own little compartment, you know, and then go on to the next one. So that's a little bit easier. But for putting those books together individually, it's just, I mean, it's very, it's mystifying, even to the writer, you know, what comes where. It really is.
I bet.
And then you have to pick a title for it. You know, you pick a title, you usually pick one of the poem titles, and then you say to yourself, is that the right one?
Yeah. So what are the titles of your chapbooks?
Well, chapbooks are small poetry books.
Right.
And then there are regular poetry books.
Okay, so you've done both?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have four full-length collections. The last one was called The Warhol Pillows. And it was taken from the title of a poem in the book that was about a trip I took to the Warhol Museum in, where is it? It's in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, of course. And there's a room filled with these helium-filled silver pillows that float all around. It was just marvelous, and you can walk through it. So that was the poem I picked for the title of that.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, I guess in your press release it said that you had published four print chapbooks, but really it's four.
There must have been something deleted there, because I know they were listed. They're four full-length poetry books and then four print chapbooks.
Okay. So I'm looking at your website, which is dianewald.org, and so we have the Warhol Pillows, Wonder Bender.
Yeah. That I made up.
That's cool. The Yellow Hotel.
Yellow Hotel. That was a favorite. That's another, you know, New England place.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then Lucid Suitcase.
Yes.
Is that a reference to lucid dreaming?
It could be.
It's
the title of a very short poem, but yeah, it brings in a lot of sort of surreal imagery, I think.
Yeah. And then your full-length novel was titled My Famous Brain?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and what was that about?
I love that book. I love the characters. I love all my characters. I feel like, you know, they're family members. That was about a man who was a professor in a small college in New Jersey, and here's another person with an unusual talent. He could memorize books, among other things. He was very, very smart. And he was part of a study of genius children when he was a kid. So he was very, very smart. And he, it's about his adventures in academia, more or less.
So he had a photographic memory?
Yeah.
Wow.
But he focused on books, so he would recite them to people, you know.
Have you ever known anyone who had a photographic memory?
I did.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that person very well, but obviously it's stuck in my mind.
Yeah. And then what was Gilliflower, your first novella? What was that about?
Oh, Gilliflower is a real fantasy. It's about another young girl who's kind of an artist. She wants to be an illustrator, but she has a crush on this English actor. She always loves to go to his movies and everything. And then one day she realizes that he's going to do a play in New York City. And her mother gets her tickets. She sees the play. She sits in the front row, and she has a moment of recognition, she feels, with this actor. And I can't tell you any more than that because it's a very short book, and you would know. But that was a lot of fun to write.
Now,
that was written from four points of view. So the actor's point of view, her point of view, her husband's point of view. So, yeah, that was fun.
Oh, interesting. So you mentioned that the first two novels you published were things you had worked on off and on for many, many years and kind of hidden away, and then you brought them out 6 or 7 years ago. What prompted that revisiting of those works?
I guess it was office cleaning, perhaps. So I found them in box. I found them in a box, and I started looking at them and reading them again, and I thought, gee, maybe now I've lived enough to finish these books, you know. I remember showing them to people at the time that I wrote them, and they liked them, but I didn't trust it. I didn't have enough confidence in writing prose or writing fiction to trust what people were saying. So I just decided to put them away.
And did you make a lot of changes to them?
I mean,
were they better than you thought they were to begin
they were,
with?
They were both better and worse. In some ways, they were worse because, you know, I'm a lot older, and I've done a lot more writing and learned a lot more things since then. So, but they were better. In my mind, they were really good stories, and that's what I was hoping would happen. And so I was able to clean them up a lot. I think I did the most cleaning up on My Family's Brain because, well, it was longer, but it was also kind of a mess. It kind of didn't it didn't fit together the way I wanted it to, you know. So I did a lot of work on that one.
Now, in your intro, I mentioned some of the different day jobs that you've held. And how did you fit writing in around those jobs, around your work?
Well, some of them were easier than others. Like the teaching jobs and the when I worked in the art school as a dean of faculty, and there was more time around that. But then I somehow... I have a great love for animals, and I got tired of teaching, and I had some bad experiences in academia, so I decided I would look for something else, and I got this job as a writer, in-house writer for this gigantic animal welfare organization, and believe it or not, that just sort of took over my life. I worked there for 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And the good thing about it, writing-wise, I didn't have enough time to write, but the good thing about it was that I was writing every day. I was writing press releases. I was writing grants. I was writing articles for magazines. So I think it develops your writing muscle, whatever that is. You know, it gives you a lot of practice, and it gives you access to a lot of words that you might have forgotten or didn't realize you could use well, you know. So I really do think that was a pretty good thing.
I bet, I bet. And then did you retire from that? Did you keep that job until retirement?
I did. I retired from that job. And then after that, the last four books came after retirement.
Wow.
The Warhol Pillows, the Gilliflower, My Famous Brain, and the Bay Roads Files.
And that's just been in the last 4 years, I think?
It's going on five.
Going on five. So yeah. That's... feels very prolific.
Well, I mean, as you said, the two of the novels were mostly revision.
Right.
The Barrows Files was the only one I wrote completely within like 2 years.
Okay. So will you write more novels?
Gosh, I hope so. I really hope so, because it's such fun. So I have a couple of loose ideas, but nothing has hit me yet the way that Violet's book hit me. So I'm waiting.
Do you ever
write short stories?
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the market for short stories these days? Is there, you know, magazines have kind of, you know, we don't have all the magazines that used to publish
right.
short stories. So is it just short story collections essentially, and maybe some literary magazines still?
Oh, I think. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking as a newcomer to writing short stories, but I've been able to publish a lot of them online, for one thing. That's,
okay.
That's easy.
Where online do you publish?
There are places you can look for suggestions to where they'll fit in. Mm-hmm. I couldn't name them off the top of my head because I haven't done them that much. But and there are the big places that still take really good stories. So everybody always tries anyway. You always try for the New Yorker and you try for this one and that one. But
Right.
I think writing short stories and writing poetry in terms of marketing them are very similar. I mean, it's tough.
Yeah. And there are still literary magazines, both print and online, and university press publications. And
Yeah.
So there are places out there. But yeah, it is. Some of the, like back when I was writing short stories back in the 80s, and a lot of the markets don't exist anymore, so it's all different. But publishing as a whole has changed so much.
Yeah.
So how did you find your publisher for your fiction?
The Barrows Files was the best thing. Submitted it to, but you started out this whole interview saying that novellas were hard to publish, and they are. But Barrows Files came in second in 3 contests for novellas, all in the same year. And one of them was Regal House. And when I looked at their website, I just thought, oh, God, I want to be with them. You know, they do everything so beautifully. And so I wrote to Janie Royal, the head of the company, and said, I was on your long list for this award. Do you think you could take another look at it? Because, you know, the awards are chosen by an outside person. So I figured maybe she hadn't seen it.
Mm.
And she said, yeah, okay, send it in. So I sent it in, and it took a long, they have a long, arduous selection process. And I was really sweating by the time I got to the end, but they took it. And I was so happy because I met a couple of other novella writers through them.
Wow. And your other two, I see, were published by She Writes Press. Now, I've done quite a few authors from She Writes. They are a hybrid publisher.
Right.
So can you kind of explain how that worked? They do good work. They put out good books.
They really, really do.
Yeah.
And, well, the reason I decided to go with them, with Gillyflower, I tried to get an agent. I was dumb enough to think that I could get one with having no experience in writing fiction. And I couldn't get one. I got lots of nice no's, though, you know. And so I thought, I'm no spring chicken, and I don't want to wait, you know, till I'm 95. To find a publisher. So they accepted both books, you know, on the first try. And I think they're beautiful books, and they did a lot of good stuff with them.
So they do provide editing services, right?
Yep.
And cover design and typography and layout and and distribution.
That's right.
But so the difference between that and a traditional publisher, which Regal House is more of
Regal
a traditional
House.
Publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is the main difference?
Well, the difference in the preparation of the book, with She Writes, they would give you a choice. They have an in-house person who does the covers. And it's funny when you're writing these, when I'm writing, I'm always picturing these covers. They're usually impossible to, you know, create, but you always have some kind of idea of what you would like. And so with She Writes, they would give you six or seven options for the cover. It was really quite a pleasure to do that. With She Writes, they give you an opportunity to give them a lot of input, but then they tell you, okay, we're gonna look at this, we're gonna read this, and then we're gonna give you the cover that we know will sell the book. So you get one. You get one cover.
With Regal House or with She, which one gives
Regal
you?
House.
Regal House gives
Regal
you.
Regal House gives you one.
They make the decision, basically.
They make the decision. They do.
They take your input.
You
yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I at first was a little not in love with it, with this cover, but it really, honest to God, has grown on me so much, because now when I look at the cover, I see those. The clouds in the sky, they're not just fluffy white sunny day clouds. You know, it kind of looks like trouble is coming.
Mm.
And I like the bright colors, and I've had many, many people say to me, oh yeah, I was in the bookstore and it jumped right off the table at me. So what do I know? I think they do know what they're doing.
They probably do. Probably do. What about the editing process? Is there a difference between the two?
You know, I'm such a perfectionist. It's not always a good thing, but I've been a proofreader, I've been a copy editor. By the time I turn in my stuff, I really never get very much copy editing or proofreading, except little things. But I've never had anyone say, oh, you gotta, you know, move this chapter or do something drastic like that. I think so I had pretty easy experience. They're very thorough, but I had very easy experiences with both presses.
Okay. And so the main difference is maybe how the financial aspect works?
Yeah. And they're similar in most other ways. I mean, when I got to Regal House, I thought, well, now I won't have that cohort of other writers who are going to be published in the same time frame that my book is coming out, but they do exactly the same thing, and it's great. So you get to know all the other people who, in my case, come out in summer 2025, and it was fun. We had an email list, and we would have Zooms occasionally, and you felt like you weren't alone. You know, that was a great thing too. I don't know, maybe all publishers do that now. I really just don't know.
Is there a difference in how much marketing is done on your behalf?
Yes. I think Regal House has a very strong feel for marketing, and they guide you into what you can do, you know, what you can do on Facebook, what you can do with this bookstore. They have a handbook that's, you know, 3 inches thick.
And oh, wow.
It's wonderful, though. It's wonderful because, especially for people like me, every question is in there. And if it's not in there, you can ask them. They're very accessible.
Have you done any readings in Provincetown?
I haven't. I'm hoping to get one coming up maybe in August, but I can't yet. it's iffy.
It's okay.
Really,
so is the place where you went in Provincetown, does it still exist?
Oh yeah.
The Fine Arts Work Center?
Yes, it's you can look it up. It's fawc.org. And oh yeah, it's amazing now. I mean, when I was there, I think it was like the fifth year they'd been in existence, and everything was very it was like, I don't know what I would compare it to. It was in its babyhood, you know, and now it's so official. It's very well funded. The writers who go there now are very famous already.
Mm.
And the people who went there when I was there, we were just falling out of our cribs, and now they're getting Pulitzer Prizes. You know? So
wow.
Jane Ann Phillips went there. I saw that she was going to be out there doing things this week. And so, you know, there are many, many famous people who have gone there, and it's all been rebuilt and redone. So it's fancy.
Well, is there any chance of you, like, doing something there with this book?
I think so. They don't do that because don't forget all the people who have gone through the program have things to present. So they can't take you back.
Yeah, that's true. So, but will you be going to Provincetown this summer or this fall?
Well, yeah, I think my husband and I will definitely go. Yeah. Sure. I'll slip a few books in my pocket and see if I can sell them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, and you still live in Massachusetts, right?
I live in Dedham. It's about 7 miles south from Boston.
Okay. Okay. And how far is that from Provincetown?
It's about a little over 2 hours.
Now, when you were writing the Bayrose Files, did you do some reconnaissance trips up there to get the...
Really, because as I said, it started during COVID, and nobody was going to hotels then or going to, you know, anywhere much. So I didn't.
Right.
But I didn't really need to. I mean,
you'd been there enough, often enough.
It was like a home. Yeah. Yeah.
Have things changed there since you were there in the 70s?
Oh my God. Yeah. It's very crowded. It's very well known. Famous people go there all the time. I saw a picture just the other day of Rachel Maddow strolling down the street. You know, it's in the summer. Don't go there in the summer. I mean, unless you're very brave. the beaches are still gorgeous. Thank goodness it's part of the National Seashore Park, so it can't become Coney Island. You know, the beaches are gorgeous. There's still a lot of art out there, beautiful things to see. But off season is the time to go and really get the feeling for the place.
Wow. Well, Diane, I want to thank you for being with us today. Diane Wald, author of The Bayrose Files. And we always close the show with a quote. And since you open your book with a quote from Leonard Cohen, I figured I would close our show with one of my favorite quotes from him.
Oh.
There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Oh, fantastic. He's the best.
He is.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.